Hi, everybody. My name is Maddie. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Let me just start off by clearing up a few things about what that term recovered actually means. It seems to be kind of off-putting to some people. Recovered means that I've gone through 12 steps with a sponsor through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that the spiritual awakening that is guaranteed was given to me, and I stand here a free man. And that's really why I came here to share this with you, is that I'm a free man today. My sobriety date is July 7th, 2008. That wasn't my first sobriety date, which I will get into. But I'm a grateful servant, and let me also say, too, that this is not my idea of fun. Standing up in front of a bunch of strangers, and I'm going to talk. I constantly get complaints from friends or clients of mine that I don't talk. So it's hard to get me to talk for like 5 minutes, let alone an hour. But I'm doing this because that spiritual awakening is taking place, and I feel it, you know, because there are a lot of people that came before me that shared that message with me, that I feel that I now have to carry that same responsibility that they had. So like I said, July 7th, 2008. Let's go before that, obviously. I'm going to tell you what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I don't know if I was born with this thing. I hear some people say that there is a genetic component to this thing. I don't know. I'm not a geneticist. What I do know is that it runs in my family. And my dad and my uncle are both alcoholics. My uncle has, he just celebrated 37 years. My dad just celebrated 35 on the 3rd. Or 36, actually, I'm sorry. So I never knew my dad drunk. I knew what it was like growing up with somebody that's dry. I know what that looks like. When he wouldn't go to a meeting and we would sit and just beg him, please go to a meeting. And it worked for him. Starting off in childhood, I'd never felt that I fit in. I didn't feel a part of, and I was okay with that. Honestly, I just stuck my nose in my sketchbooks, and I was a lot happier there. Keeping a conversation with people was always a difficult feat for me. But other than that, there was that inner unmanageability from an early age, because I can think back to, I guess the first time I really noticed it was when I was, I was 7 years old, and it was around the dinner table, and we had the first family meeting, and my parents told all of us that my dad was diagnosed with Hep C, and at that time, there was no cure, there was little, if any, kind of treatment for it, something he'd contracted back in Vietnam. Because he was honest with the doctors and told them that he was, a sober alcoholic, that they dropped him on the lowest part of that list for the liver transplant. So in a sense, it was like a death sentence for him. And I know that I have two older brothers and a younger sister. My mother and my father, they were all having different experiences, hearing the same information. But for me, I was worried about how is that going to look for me. What does that matter to me, how is this going to affect me, and cared little, if any, about, showing up to the family, or I was 7 at the same time, too, give myself a little bit of a leeway, but that's the way I thought, that's the way I think, I have an alcoholic mind, later on, I was a little punk rock kid, skateboarder, did all the kind of things that, fringe society people did, and that's where I felt like I fit in. And even then, with that crowd, I didn't necessarily even fit in there. And then when I was 13, the first thing I did, and I'm going to mention this too, and I want the let me preface this by saying that I respect the house that I'm in. I identify myself as being an alcoholic because I am one. But my story also entails other things. You know, I qualify for other fellowships also. And that's really what got me into everything. You know, as I was growing up, before I even touched anything, any drug or drink or anything, you know, we would all get the warnings around the Christmas table, the kitchen table, where my dad would be giving us the warnings against alcohol. It was always about alcohol. Stay away from alcohol. It was just bad. So I found these other things that were that, you know, they didn't talk about. And so I thought that was kind of a loophole. And this thing happened. It was like, you know, it wasn't like, you know, this great thing, but there was a little bit of relief that I got. And that for me is what alcohol gives me, is this feeling that I can't provide for myself. It's this sense that, like, I can be okay with who I am within my skin. You know, hanging with the people I'm hanging with and doing the things that I'm doing with them. And without that, that to me is what alcoholism is. That's what it looks like to me. Is how am I when I don't have something in my system? I don't do well. So when these things started coming into my life, it was like, you know, all these people have been lying to me. You know, the DARE program or the Nancy Reagan Just Say No and all that kind of stuff. Like, I was like, this is they've been hiding it. They're just stockpiling it for themselves, and they don't want us to hit anything. And that carried on. Then that all escalated pretty quick. I remember, you know, the first time I drank, it wasn't, I don't necessarily remember. Maybe that means that I did get drunk. I don't remember getting drunk, but I remember feeling some of the relief from that. You know, the other substances were taking a hold, and I remember that there was the first family intervention. I think I was about 16, and I said I was going to stop. You know, I was going to stop with everything else that I was doing. And my dad suggested that, being a good AA, a member of AA, suggested that I go see, because I wasn't willing to come into these rooms. I'd been to meetings before, but I didn't want any part of this. He suggested that I go see a drug and alcohol counselor, and, you know, we just go with what he says I had to do. I went in there, and I only mildly lied, and the guy said, well, you know, at that point, my progression really wasn't that getting all that bad, but he was like, I think you'd be fine. So I managed to put all that stuff down, but then again, you know, there again, it was like what I said before. What happens to me when I don't have something in my system is I don't do so well, you know. In the doctor's opinion, Dr. Silkworth refers to it as that there's an irritable, restless, discontent kind of feeling that I have. That's me without a substance. After I put down the other stuff, that's when drinking started taking a hold. You know, that was, you know, I thought it was like, well, this is legal. It's, even though I wasn't of age, and you know, it's just, yeah, everybody does it. You know, they have commercials on TV about it. So, and immediately I started drinking alcoholically. That relief. You know, it was working. It was very effective. And I, shortly after that, I want to say it's about when I was 18, I was drinking at the place where I was working, and we were there late, and it was about a mile away from my home. Now, at that time, I wasn't a dumb guy. I don't know whether I am now, but at that time I know I wasn't. I knew better than to get in my car and to drive. I knew that. I would look on the people that would drive drunk and say, you know, well, I'm never going to do that. I'm smarter than that. And it came down to, I had two options. I was either going to try to sleep it off in my car and have my boss show up within an hour to open the place back up, or I was going to try and drive less than a mile to my house. And I went with door number two, and I never made it home. I drove right into a median and put my face through the windshield, and then I ripped it back through and tore my nose off, had glass all on my face. And if the guy that I was working with hadn't taken that, which was different for him, it was a different route for him to go home. If he hadn't taken that route, God only knows what would happen, you know. But he was able to call and get help. And that was the first time my mom got the phone call really, really late. I think I want to say it was about 3 or 4 in the morning. And somebody from the police department was telling her that her son's in the hospital and that it doesn't look so good. And, you know, I vaguely remember little bits after that. Like, it was really kind of fuzzy. Definitely some memory loss. But what I do remember is I remember opening my eyes when coherence started to come back. And I remember looking up and I remember seeing my mom. And she had this look that it's burned in my memory. She had this look of, but she was trying to be tough, but I knew that behind those eyes she was really, really scared. And, you know, and that spooked me, you know. I had little, if any, concern about myself at that point. I was more concerned about her, making sure that she was going to be okay. And, you know, a few days after that, I remember being in the hospital room. They'd already routed up my room and found all the hidden bottles and all that kind of stuff. And I remember my dad stuck around after the rest of the family left the room. And he shut the door, and I knew this was about to get serious. And that was also the second family intervention. But I remember him saying a couple things. He said, just before he left, he says, my biggest worry right now is that you're not done. And I looked at him and I was like, I'm done. You know, I tried all this stuff and I've been trying to drink and look what it's got me. You know, it was all just like a series of failed experiments with different things. And, you know, it's kind of like I was checking them off a list. And I swore to him, and I meant it. You know, if you'd hooked me up to a polygraph, that needle wouldn't have moved. I meant it. I was going to be done. I was never going to drink again. And I think a rational thinking person or a hard drinker would have been able to do that and accomplish that. A guy like me, like I said, I don't do so well without substances in my system. And I was dry. That also like landed me in the rooms again. I had to get the sheet signed. I don't know if any of you guys have ever had to do that. It's not fun. But I would just come in, and it was like I was, you know, just punching in and punching out. I would hear a lot of like slogans and. You know, it was just very foreign, very, I don't know, very uncomfortable for me. And at that time, I didn't know what I was up against. I didn't really know what an alcoholic was, you know. Because you tell somebody you're an alcoholic, they usually conjures up a bunch of different images in their head. You know, one could be the guy that's panhandling on the side of the road, or it could be, you know, a guy that's riding in a train car, or, you know, a number of different things. I certainly didn't think myself an alcoholic at that time. So I was dry for a little while, I want to say a couple years. Let me say this, in those couple years, I was 18, 19, and 20. I was having the back problems that somebody who's like in the mid-60s experiences. I had to go see a chiropractor because of all the stress and this anger. You know, my nickname was anger management. And I just, the relationships with people, it was just this constant. It was just like life was just killing me, you know. There was no joy in my life, you know. And then something happened with this relationship that I was in, and I turned to my friend and I said, let's go get a six pack. I just need some kind of relief. And we did, and I got the relief I was looking for, and it was very effective. You know, the drinking didn't really take off right away after that. I still had a little bit, I was still a little gun shy from it, but, you know, there was definitely enough of it. Every time I drank, I got drunk. I knew I drank a little bit differently than everybody else. You know, I was the guy, you know, with the fake ID that was getting into these bars, and I was staying till the end, and everybody else was like, you know, they'd be looking at their watches saying things like, I gotta go home. And I'm like, screw tomorrow, you know? And, you know, and then it carried off in other things again, and that's, you know, what I'll say is this, is that when I, there was a point that I remember where I was driving to a good buddy of mine's house, and this thought occurred to me that I was at that point in time living my dreams. I wanted to be a musician. I wanted to be an artist who got, you know, earned a living with it. And I had this girlfriend who I loved very much, and you know, things were just looking up. You know, I was playing in a very busy band, touring around a lot, playing, you know, a working band, and it was like my dream had been realized, you know, at that point in time. And it wasn't long after that that things started to go by the wayside. You know, my drinking started to get in the way of it. I don't know if any of you guys have experience with playing bands that were like that, but there's a lot of alcohol and other things that go on in there, and if somebody's singling you out, there's probably a problem. And that was me, you know, the fingers being pointed at me, and I was being, you know, I was kicked out, and then they let me back, and then they kicked me out again, and I want to say there was one other time in there. But yeah, they just couldn't keep me. I was too much of a liability. And then the shop where I was working, which had been there for, I want to say 14 or 15 years, had a good name, you know, it was a great shop, and I had an equal part in that shop going under. So then, you know, all along the way, I'm like living couch surfing, which is just a fancy way of saying I was homeless, getting arrested, you know, more phone calls late at night to my mom, and sometimes my dad if I really felt squirrely. And that was the way I was living, you know, like I'm just treading water and I'm not getting anywhere. I remember, I want to say I was maybe about 24-ish, and I finally was just like, I'm done, I won't do this anymore. And I went into a detox facility. You know, I get real compliant in places like that. And, you know, the oversight doctor was, you know, he would talk about how impressed he was with me, and I'm just like, you know, like this, you know, all-star detoxer. and like, it got me an early release, because I wasn't getting out of there until he approved it. And I felt good when I left there, you know. And if you had asked me then, you know, because it was, I mean, any of you guys that have any experience being in any of those kinds of places, like, it's like, you know, you feel like your freedom gets taken, and it's very uncomfortable. And I never wanted to go back there. And that was just yet another time that I swore that I was never going to go back to it. I was done. For me to say that I made it 2 weeks really gives myself a lot of credit. But that's kind of what I want to say. It may have even been a week, but that week was miserable. The girlfriend left, the band didn't want me, the shop was under. And I was just, you know, I was hollowed out, you know, empty. No real relationships with anybody. I never lost any of the love that I had for my family or even my close friends, but, you know, they had to take a back seat when it came to my alcoholism. And can everybody hear me all right? Perfect. So I get out of there in 2 weeks. Within that 2 weeks, I remember calling up a buddy of mine. I was like, listen, man, I need some relief. I need something. Because these meetings that I'm going to where people are complaining about their day, and it's just a round robin. Everybody's trying to, like, outdo the next one, you know? Like, yeah, this guy, he's lost his house. Well, this guy, he's lost two houses. This guy's on his third wife. Well, this guy's on his fifth wife. And I'm like, I don't even have a home. I don't have a car. I don't really do any of this stuff, you know? And that's what I thought AA was. I thought AA was a support group or something of the ilk. For me, it was just didn't, you know, something I didn't fit into, you know? I do remember seeing those 12 steps. They were hanging on the wall. Occasionally, somebody would mention something about them. But I would inevitably, like, just feel like I didn't belong, and I'm just going to go this my own way, you know? So I didn't, you know, I was planning on just going out for a night, just getting a relief. You know, I just wanted to be able to sleep a whole night. And it wasn't just one night. You know, I was out for the better part of 2 years. And by the end of that, you know, I'd still maintained, you know, I was, my clothes were in a garbage bag, you know. I never had any money. You know, just mooching off of goodwill people, you know, my mother, most of all. She would boot me out, and then I would talk to her and come back, and then she would do it again, and then I would come back. And then always with these false promises. But, you know, the truth was, at that time, like, I really did mean it. You know, every time I said, I don't want to drink again, I really meant it. I didn't know what I was up against, you know. And that last time, I remember, word had gotten to my sister from a close friend of mine that I was at it again. And she went and told my mom, and they both came down into my room, and they were pissed. And I was ready for that fight. You know, I've been through that fight. I know exactly how it's going to play out, you know. But something changed in my mom. And I remember shortly into that fight, I remember her eyes changed, and I remember her saying that she's never going to give up fighting for me. And, I mean, there's no fighting with that. You know, how do you fight against somebody who loves you? You know? She caught me off guard. And something changed in that moment. There was a desperation I had never had before. And I said I would go back to the detox place, but she said, I want you to go to treatment. And she stated a couple of reasons, and the one that really stuck out to me was that she just wanted a good night's sleep. And, you know, I consented, you know. I didn't have a dollar to my name, and I got an appointment with the County Board of Health to see if I qualified for a scholarship program to go into this treatment facility, a state-run. And I went in for this evaluation. I'm sitting down, and a very nice lady. She's asking me a lot of questions. She's asking me at what age I was doing what, and she's just writing it down. Very simple, very, very plain. And as she's asking these questions, I start to go into, well, you see, at this age, it was I had this group of friends, and they were doing this thing. And I felt like, well, you know, it was working for them. And she's like, I don't care about any of that. Tell me what you were doing and when you were doing it. She just wanted the facts. She didn't want to know how I felt. She didn't want to know you know, all the rationalizations that I had running around in my head. And by the end of that list, by the time we finished it, I'd seen on that piece of paper that that's what my life had amounted to. That was the truth, you know. And that hurt, you know. That leveled what was left of my ego. I knew I didn't have a clue. I knew I didn't know about anything. I didn't know how to do this life thing. I didn't know enough about recovery. You know, I could see that I have two examples of it working in my family, and yet I why is it not working for me? And but I learned when I went into treatment that the only things that I hadn't done was get a sponsor, go through 12 steps and get a big book, were the things that I should have done on day one. People were coming into that treatment facility, and they were carrying that message, and I'm really grateful to all those people, because it was, I don't know if the people in the meetings that I was attending before that weren't sharing the message, because they very well could have been. I just wasn't ready to hear it. You know, that could very well be the truth. But for some reason, when I was in that treatment facility and the things that these people were saying, I believed them. I believed that those 12 steps transported them into that fourth dimension. And I started to get this thought, like, for the first time, that maybe this thing can work for me. You know, the only thing I hadn't done was 12 steps. Tried everything, you know. I did the Geographic, moved to California at one point, and then moved back. I was living a lot in New Orleans, and that never worked, you know. I tried the changing of friends. I've tried changing the places where I work. Tried changing the bars that I would frequent. I tried stopping on my own countless times, and always came up short. So this other thing happened to me too while I was in that treatment facility, is that I started to listen to what other people were suggesting to me. You know, I started following rules, which is totally new, and it was working. And you know, slowly but surely, I started to get a little more hope. You know, physically I felt terrible, but mentally, that hope was like kind of pulling me along, and I was starting to feel a little bit better mentally, somewhat. And then they, about halfway through my stay there, my whatever counselor pulled me in her office, and she said, "We think it'd be a good idea for you to go down to Florida." Now understand, like I had a shop I was going to go work at. As soon as I got out, I was going to go to specific meetings. I was going to go attend some of these with my dad. And you know, I had everything in place, place where I was going to live. Everything was in place for when I get out of there. And now they're throwing a wrench in the works. And my thought was, all right, that's fine. If you guys think that's what's best, then try it. I was supposed to be down there on a six-month commitment. I ended up staying for 6 years. First day down there, you know, well, the majority of that day I spent in the airport waiting for the guy to pick me up. Gets me to the halfway house, and I get all signed in, went to the meeting, and right after that meeting I got my first sponsor. I didn't pick him. I would never have picked this guy, ever. Nothing about our lives looked at all similar, you know. I hear people say, you know, find a sponsor that, like, has what you want and all those kind of things, but this guy had nothing I wanted. At that time, I didn't know, you know. What I did know by the end of that first talk with him was that he was sober 3+ years. He had gone through the 12 steps, he had a sponsor, and he was, you know, somewhat familiar with the big book. And that's all I cared about, you know, all the rest of it. Whatever, you know. I remember asking my sponsor once, you know, what's a temporary sponsor? He's like, well, that's for people that want temporary recovery. And So I went through with him, and we went through really quick. So by the time I had 60 days, I was putting my hand up to sponsor people. That's my experience. I know a lot of people don't have that same experience, but I'm just here to share mine. And for me, I needed relief, and I needed relief. I knew that, like, based on the last window of time that I was working with, that 2 weeks, giving myself credit, that it was a very small one, and I had to act fast, you know? Otherwise, this thing was creeping. That window of opportunity is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and I had to get busy. And for me, going through those 12 steps, my sponsor never held me back. You know, we also didn't rush, you know? I think writing a 4-step took me all of 2 nights, and I set aside maybe 3 hours each. There was stuff that came up after that, but that's not what the book warns against, you know? The book warns against, you know, if there's stuff that you are aware of and are and editing your 4-step, then there could be consequences from that. I wrote down everything that I knew and I searched out, and it was an honest and thorough 4-step at that point in time. And I remember sharing that 5th step, and I remember feeling that relief. I remember finishing up doing that, my sponsor was still there, and I was like, all right, well, this is cool, you know. He just heard everything, the deepest, darkest, dirtiest stuff. He knows all the nooks and crannies, you know, about me and my life, and he's still here, and he's smiling. And I remember him saying to me, you know, you don't ever have to feel that way again. And something about the way he said it in that moment, it hit me, and I realized that you know, all those promises that had been promised up to that point were taking hold of my life. You know, and then we quickly got busy. You know, all the instructions in the big book direct me to keep going and keep moving, and that's what I did. Follow the instructions. Very shortly after that, I was making amends. I was getting on a plane to come back up to the Northeast here and make amends. And I mean, there were some wrongs that I didn't think could have been righted. There were some amends that I did not want to make. For instance, I had this one guy that I worked with for years, and we just left on really bad terms, and we went from being really close to, like, you know, yelling death threats through the phone at each other, you know, and I never wanted to see this guy again. And I knew after I'd made my 8th step that this guy was going to be, you know, I was going to have to go to him. He was on the, you know, because I had to break my amends list into right now, soon, maybe, and never, and this guy was on the never. But I was also instructed from doing the 8th step that I had to pray for that willingness, and I did. Also, something very new for me, you know, pray. I started talking about God, and I don't know, you know, I just caught fire, and I you know, it's funny the way I, you know, it's like sometimes I'll think about, like, me 15 years ago, what I would think of me now, you know. I get a kick out of it. So I'm walking the convention floor after being down in Florida for a few months, and there's the guy I don't want to see. He's on the never list. And I just did one of those, like, looked up, and I was like, all right, wherever possible, right? And I went up, and I made the approach, I asked him if I could, you know, just bend his ear for a little bit. We went outside and I laid it all out. I one of those situations where there were definitely some wrongs on his end, and it was my job in that case to forgive him for them. But the things that I had done to him, I had to ask for forgiveness from him, and I did. And probably the most rewarding one, you know, knocking some of those off of the never list. You know, for me, going to my mom, it was very easy. Anybody in my family and the friends and all that kind of stuff, it was, you know, those were more emotional than, but this one really kind of changed my whole perspective on everything. I thought for sure I was going to, like, you know, it was going to end with us, you know, fighting it or something. So yeah, and then, you know, getting into disciplines of 10, 11, and 12, and that's where I live today. You know, and then sponsoring guys. So like I said, I put my hand up when I had 60 days, and I've been sponsoring ever since, you know. Something happens when you get to be of service to somebody else, selflessly. You know, this is, for those of you that have had experience with that, you know what it is that I'm talking about. But something happens when you sit across from another person who is where you have been, and you get to show them the way out that worked with you. Laying out that spiritual kit of tools at their feet for their own inspection, and to watch, you know, a lot of their wrongs get righted, watch their families get brought back together. It's amazing. It really is a miracle. You know, I really believe that it's a miracle, and I don't use that word lightly. But I don't know what else to call what happens to us when we go through 12 steps. You know, we don't resemble anything like we once did, for the better, you know. And I think that was another fear of mine, is like, you know, what's going to happen to me after these 12 steps? Am I going to become, like, you know, a khaki-wearing, you know, kind of... I didn't. I kind of went the opposite way. I think I got more tattoos and piercings and all that stuff. But that's part of the hazards. So my life now, what does my life look like now? My relationship with my family is, I wouldn't trade it for anything, you know? What I would say is a great relationship with every one of my family members. I have two nieces and a nephew, and my one niece, just, she's like my little shadow. And, you know, to go for, like, where that's what it is now, when I would say it would have to be like about 9 years ago now, my one brother was about to get married, and they almost canceled the wedding because they wanted to do another family intervention on me. To go from that to where things are today, it's just amazing, you know? I still work in my field. I still play music pretty regularly. Which, you know, I kind of wanted to talk about that because that's something that kind of comes up pretty regularly with me. For some reason, like, you know, that's the kind of people I'm drawn to. You know, I was worried that when I put down the drink that I wasn't going to be as good or creative musically or artistically. And what I found is that couldn't have been further from the truth. That I think right now that I've never been able to get into that zone as much now as I was back when I was out there. And I think too that kind of served me really well when I came into the rooms. You know, I came in, you know, especially with the God issue. I was one of those that wrestled with it. I mean, who amongst us hasn't? You know, I think every one of us has some form of agnosticism. How could we not? You know. We're alcoholics. We weren't able to stop, and we weren't implementing this power. Like, whether you were a believer or non-believer, if you were a believer, then what were you believing in if it wasn't able to solve that problem? So you had some form of agnosticism. That's just my take on it. And that certainly was me. You know, I had some spiritual beliefs to that point, but none of them, you know, I wasn't able to enact them, you know. I certainly, like I said earlier, I wasn't aware of what it was I was up against. I didn't know anything about the mental obsession. I didn't know anything about the physical allergy. And I certainly didn't know about that spiritual malady. But that understanding, that kind of zone, little, you know, that place that you know, you end up going, when I'm in the middle of a painting or something, the time just kind of like, you know, dissipates and you get lost in it, and before you know it, it's like sun up and you know, you got to get some sleep. But there was something that kind of takes over, and it's the same thing with music for me. You know, I'll be in the middle of playing and, you know, you just get out of the way. You just let it go. And it's almost as if you're just kind of there observing. You're not really at the wheel, you know. It's kind of magic, and it's so for me, there was an understanding. There was that helped me out when I first came in into understanding that, like, get out of the way and let God do His thing, you know. That was really what I started with, was like, whatever that thing is, the call it ethereal or whatever, whatever that thing is, that there is something to it, you know. A lot of poets, a lot of painters, a lot of musicians, anybody that does anything creatively, they all talk about it, and now I am. So that really helped me out coming in, getting around that, you know, because that, you know, I worshipped that a different altar prior to coming in here. It was one of intellect and you know, self knowledge, and I really thought that I had everything figured out, and I didn't, you know, the open mind that I came in here with was also like really key in order to help me to realize that I didn't have it all figured out. I didn't know anything about this God thing, you know. But the big book, where Bill talks about it, and we agnostics, and he says, you know, he uses a lot of terms for this God thing, and he talks about the spirit of the universe. You know, that to me was like speaking directly to me, you know. And so here I am now, standing in front of a bunch of people, and I am telling you guys that I'm a believer. I'm no longer a Gnostic or atheist. I believe with every fiber of my being that there is something out there, and I know that because I'm here, and because it's working in my life. I have great friends, you know, great sponsor, and yeah.